Now we are now discussing this long period, which we might call the Dark Ages. It is a period of which we know less than we do about the periods before or the periods after. It is a period which is between 500 and 600 years in length. We spent all our time last semester and thus far this semester on the very important events of slightly over 400 years of church history. Now we are going rapidly in the course of a week or two over a period of considerably longer than that whole period we've looked at thus far, this period 500 to 600 years. It is much longer than the period since before the beginning of the Reformation up to the present. So you see that of the period since the coming of Christ, it is a very long section. And it is a section of which not one-fifth, not one-twentieth, I should say, is known as about the 400 years before. I'm speaking secular history now, just in general. Not one-twentieth is known as about the 400 years before it, or as about the 500 years, the last 500. Between this and the period we're now looking at, there's another period of 500 years, which is about halfway between, in our knowledge, between that period and the modern time. We'll spend quite a bit more time on that period than we're spending on this 500 to 600 year period. But in this period, there are a few events which are important as laying foundations for events of the succeeding year. And these few events I'd like to have you have an understanding of in the context of history. And so I'm now giving you a survey of the events, the political and cultural situation during this period. And we look at certain factors during that, and I believe at the end of the hour I think about number 8. I don't think I'd mentioned 9, had I? I was thinking of number 8, which was the political event of the rise of Islam. And we will look a little later, a little bit, at what Islam actually was, and a little bit more at its event, its relation to Christianity. Now we are simply thinking of the general situation in this dark period in Europe. And we want to bring out at this point that there was an event which occurred about one-third of the way through this period, which for the remaining two-thirds of the period made an effect that was tremendously important upon the whole of Western Europe, and which during the following 500 years was perhaps even more important in its effect upon that area than it had been during this period of which we're now speaking. It has considerably less importance in world history now than it had then, but yet very considerable to this present day. And this Islam is the proper term for what is generally in our Western world spoken of as Mohammedanism. Mohammedanism is a name taken from its founder. Christianity is properly called Christianity because it is the religion which worships Christ, which considers Christ to be the central figure in the universe, the second person of the Godhead, the only one through whom we can be saved. Islam does not take a similar relation to Mohammed, and therefore it is not as proper to call it Mohammedanism as it is to refer to our religion as Christianity. And yet it is not altogether improper to refer to it as Mohammedanism, because Mohammed was a very able and gifted individual of tremendous energy who laid the foundation of it, whose activity caused it to start, and without whom it is hard to conceive of it as having ever come into existence. We will look a little bit at his character later on when we look more at this. But now we are interested principally in the Dark Ages in Western Europe, and from that viewpoint it is important to realize that shortly after 600 AD, as you see about a third of the way through this period, shortly after 600 A.D., in a part of Arabia of which the Western world knew practically nothing, one man began energetically preaching a certain doctrine, and as a result of his preaching, gathered a few disciples about him, but aroused great antagonism and enmity in the town in which he had been brought up, until eventually it was decided to kill him. But meantime, he and his disciples had made arrangements with another town, which was an enemy of this town, to become the center of their activity. And so they fled from this town to the other town in 622 A.D. And they call that the Hegira, the flight or the departure. That flight to 622, to Medina in 622. And this flight, you might say, what difference? He was in one town, he went to another. Well, it's the beginning of Mohammedan history. All dates to the Mohammedans date from this, and properly so, because Mohammed seems to have undergone a tremendous change. Before this time, it is very hard for us to help having a great deal of sympathy for him. Against great opposition, he proclaimed there is one God. There is one God, and it is vital what relation you have to that one God. He was in an area of paganism, an area of belief in money gods, an area of all sorts of superstitions, and he proclaimed there is one God, and he proclaimed many things which are found in the Bible. And he was, stones were thrown at him, attempts were made to kill him, and it was when it became evident that he wouldn't live much longer if he stayed in this town that he fled to the other. But it is most important because a great change seems to have come over his character when he fled. During the next 10 years of his life before his death, he took an entirely different attitude. Now his attitude was not that of a preacher with a great teaching of the one God as against heathenism. His preaching now was, there is one God and Mohammed is his prophet, and everyone should obey Mohammed. And any method that you can find is worthwhile in order to bring people into subjection to this. And the result was that during the last 10 years of his life, he aroused a great movement of people who went out attacking and conquering by force of arms, and giving people the choice. Give up your heathenism, accept Mohammed's views, or be killed. And in the face of this attack, great numbers of people accepted his views, began to follow him, joined his army, and by the time of his death, he had a very large force which was on the move to conquer all parts of the world. And we will look at his teachings and at the ideas later on. But the thing we notice is that after Mohammed's death, this great militant movement continued, going from Arabia and within a very few years conquering Syria and Palestine, and going down and conquering the great land of Egypt, and going to the north and conquering what Asia Minor, coming to the very gates of Constantinople. Greek fire had just been invented, a sort of an explosive. It wouldn't seem like much today, but it was way beyond anything previously known, and it was used to drive the invaders away from the gates of Constantinople. But there they were, right at the very capital of the Roman Empire. They were driven back, and the Roman Empire held part of that territory, but they continued during all of our present period to be a menace to it until 1453, when they finally conquered it. And they went on beyond Egypt, across North Africa, and across the Straits, and conquered Spain, and came up into France, and for a time it looked as if the two wings of the crescent, one reaching toward Constantinople, the other up to Spain into France, would come together, and the whole of Europe would become completely under the sway of the followers of Mohammed. So you can readily see that anyone of any means in Europe at during the latter part of this period knew of Islam as a force which he might have to meet and which might mean either change all his views or be killed. And so Islam is a very great political force during this period. We will look at it from a religious view later on. But we look now at number 9, the Eastern Empire during this period. We notice how the Roman Empire was divided on at the death of Theodosius shortly before 400 AD among his two sons, and it never again was reunited in actuality, though in theory there were periods when the Eastern Emperor was supposed to be supreme over all of the former Roman Empire. But in the East, you have an empire which, with certain interruptions, continued until 1453, another 1,000 years. There are very few regimes in all history which have continued as long as this Eastern Roman Empire did, till it was finally conquered by the Muslims not so long before the coming of the Reformation. But this Eastern Empire was subject to great difficulty all through the period. It was subject to difficulties from the attacks of the first the Germanic tribes and then the Slavs from the north and from the west. It was subject to great attacks from the Persians, who developed a very strong force before the coming of Mohammedanism. And it was subject to attacks from the Mohammedans through a period of 800 years until it, more than 800 years until it was finally conquered entirely by them. And within the empire, there was not the stability, the central stability of the old Roman Empire, because the power of the emperor became greatly increased and exaggerated, and in the hands of weak emperors, it meant that the members of the household exerted tremendous power, and there were constantly intrigues going on among them. And we have a great deal of history. We have many details of the events during the period, but many of them are very petty squabbles over who would get the control. And we in the West do not usually pay a great deal of attention to the particular details of the great succession of emperors during this period of 1,000 years. But there are two men who are very important in their relation to the West, and I want to mention them now. Justinian I, 527 to 565. He was emperor for nearly 40 years. And this is fairly near the beginning of our period, as you see. This is before the beginning of Islam. And Justinian I was a man of very great ability, one of the most able of the emperors of the Eastern Empire. Justinian I, among his many activities, one was to have the Roman laws codified. And the Justinian Code has exerted tremendous influence in law ever since. It's a summary of the legal developments of the Roman Empire in previous centuries. But we are particularly interested in Justinian's relations to the West. And his relations to the West were affected to quite an extent by the fact that he had to defend himself against the Gothic attacks, against the attacks of the newly coming Slavs from the northwest from his area, and he had to defend himself from the rising power of the Persian Empire. And facing these two forces, he was very anxious to reconcile the Monophysites. You remember the Monophysites were the people who insisted that Jesus Christ had only one nation instead of two, and who had been condemned by the Council of Chalcedon. Now, Justinian held very strongly to the Orthodox view, but his wife inclined strongly toward the Monophysite view. But Justinian was particularly interested in making some sort of a compromise whereby he would have more loyalty to his empire from the people of the Monophysite view, which included the bulk of the Christians of Egypt at this time. And so Justinian is trying a number of times during his reign to work out some arrangement whereby he can hold his views and yet can make a sort of a compromise with these people. And that brings him into some conflict with the Western Christians who are holding strongly to the Orthodox views. And so at this point, Justinian will enter into our consideration of religious development in the West later on. Justinian, with his armies, was actually able to reconquer a considerable portion of the West. He reconquered all of North Africa, and one of his generals even conquered most of Italy. But it did not remain under his control very long. We'll say a few things more about him. We're particularly interested in the religious development. But here I'm giving you background for it. And I want to mention one other important individual at this point among the Eastern emperors. And he is 200 years later, Leo III. Leo III. Now, so many popes have been called Leo that when you mention Leo III, or as he's also called, Leo the Historian, I-S-A-U-R-I-A-N, it is easy for people to guess you're talking about one of the popes. We just noticed that Leo I was at least three times as able as any man who was bishop of Rome in his first 500 years. Well, this is a different line altogether. He is an emperor of the Eastern Empire, Leo III. He's a man who, from poor background, had risen in the army and had managed to become the emperor, Leo III. But by 717, Islam had already been in existence nearly a century. And Leo is facing the Monophysite problem and trying to unify his empire against the Mohammedans, but he also is facing an even greater problem. How to hold not only the power of his empire against the Mohammedans, but how to hold intellectually his stand against the Mohammedans. And the great outstanding position of the Mohammedans is there is one God, and Mohammed is his father. All worship of idols is wicked, all idolaters should be killed. That's the attitude of the Mohammedans, at least at that period. They were very, very strong in their insistence on this, and many of the people were wavering in their attitude because the Byzantines, that is the people of the Eastern Empire, like the people of the West, were having many superstitions gradually develop, and they were making statues of saints. And many seem to be worshiping these statues of these saints. And if you go to Eastern Canada today, you will get exactly the same impression. You will get the impression that Christ is a name of importance, but that the real important thing is what is your relation to one of these various saints whose statues you find here and there in Eastern Canada today. Well, that was a development of the Middle Ages in both West and East. We do not find it at all before the beginning, before the downfall of the Western Roman Empire, but it had come into the Eastern Empire to such an extent that the Mohammedans were saying, you both aren't monotheists, you're worshiping many gods, you're worshiping idols, you're worshiping all these things. And so Leo took a very strong position, which he called the iconoclast position. Now, iconoclast, the word icon, is the Greek word for image. It's the Greek word for image, is icon. And the last part of the name comes from the word to destroy. In other words, he was going to destroy the images. He was going to prove to the Mohammedans that his people were not idolaters, they were worshippers of the true God. He was going to gather the loyalty of his people more strongly in order that none of them would be led away into following Mohammedanism through their dislike of this image worship that was developing. And so he set to work to destroy the images. And this brought him into conflict with the religious leaders of the West, among whom the image idea had been developing even more than it had in the East. And so we have a series of controversies that we'll look at later called the iconoclastic controversy. And the end of these controversies was that Leo's followers were eventually overcome, and it was declared that there's no harm in having images so long as you don't worship them. You can take an attitude towards them which is a little short of worship, according to the theory of the Roman Catholic and Greek Catholic churches. You can take an attitude short of worship. It is, if you call it worship, it's a different sort of attitude than you take toward God, but yet much more than you take toward a living human being. And another effect it left in the Eastern Empire was that statues in churches were done away with in the East while maintained in the West. But instead of statues, they simply made flat figures on which the faces and the figure stands out a little bit on a flat surface. And so the word icon today has come to be used for a picture, that a bas-relief, I guess we call it, a picture in which the different figures stand out a little bit, and they are very common in the churches of the Eastern Orthodox, in all the Eastern Orthodox churches, are these so-called icons today. But originally, icon means any kind of statue. But they did away with the statues while they kept them in the East. And today, if you go into St. Peter's Church in Rome, you'll find there a statue of St. Peter, life-size, seated on a pedestal about as high as a pulpit, with one foot reaching forward and the feet are bare, and you see where the big toe has, from the people kissing it, has been completely worn away from the thousands and thousands of people who have kissed the toe of this statue of Peter that is there in St. Peter's Church today. They don't have statues like that in the Eastern Church today, but they have bas-reliefs with the kiss, so really there's no difference in principle. Well, these two figures, Justinian first and Leo third, we will come across in our examination of the religious events of this long period, but we now want to turn to number 10, France and Germany during this period. France and Germany during this period. Now, I am using modern terminology when I say France and Germany. We want to realize that in those days, there was no such thing as France or Germany. There was the old Roman Empire that had the province of Gaul, which is present France, and that into which the barbarians had flooded. These Gothic peoples had flooded into it, and then behind them have come the Franks, much fiercer than the Gauls, a much fiercer people, a much more ferocious people, a much more destructive people. But the Goths had been Aryan, and the people of the old Roman Empire had completely turned away from Arianism. And so they looked on these people as Christians, but yet a rather poor type of Christian. And when the Franks came in, we've already noticed this, much wilder people, more ferocious people than the Goths. The Franks eventually, just before 500 AD, the Franks accepted the religion which was standard in the Western Roman Empire, the following of the Nicene and Chalcedonian formula. But they didn't know anything about it. They simply accepted this view, and Clovis ordered all his troops to march through the river and thus be baptized and become a part of, become Christians, and they gave reverence to Christian leaders, but were about as brutal and ferocious as any group you'd ever see. But they gained control over most of what is present France and a very considerable part of what is present Germany. And from the name of the Franks has come the word France, and also the name Franconia, which is a part of Germany today. And the Franks held this territory under Clovis shortly before 500 AD, and Clovis, his successors, continued to hold it, but they passed through a large number of kings as his successors went on for more than a century, but they degenerated. We call his successors the Merovingians, after his father Merovic. The Merovingians, Merovingians, do not interest us greatly in church history. They were, Clovis is the only one of them who is of any importance to us, The rest continued through their powerful soldiers to hold this large area in subjection, in which they were looting and plundering, and the Roman civilization was rapidly dying, and the people were becoming more and more illiterate. But the leaders became weaker and weaker until you have men who gave themselves over to debauchery and simply personal enjoyment and paid no attention to their power, and it would have completely ended if it were not that one of their followers, who had assumed a position they called mayor of the palace, was a man of ability, and this office went on from him to his descendants, who were of greater ability than he. And so in 600, in the latter part of the 600, you have the Merovingians nominally ruling, but you have the mayors of the palace, the actual rulers of this large area of France and Germany. Well, now the mayors of the palace, there came one called Charles Martel. Martel means the hammer. It is a title was given to him for his ability as a soldier. But he was an able man. He died in 741. And he is very important in history because of the fact that at 730 to 100 years after the death of Mohammed, in Tours, in central France, he met the great Mohammedan army and defeated it and drove the Mohammedans out of France. And so it may be that Charles Martel, to whom we owe the fact that all of Europe today is not hearing the cries of the worship of Allah instead of being nominal Christian. It's Charles Martel who stopped the onrush of the Mohammedan forces 100 years after the death of Mohammed. But he did it in the name of the degenerate Merovingian, a descendant of Clovis, who was living in his palace in luxury and in debauchery and giving never a thought to the ruling of the great kingdom. And Charles Martel was succeeded by his son Pepin, P-E-P-E-N. And Pepin was anxious to, he had the power, he ruled well. They call him Pepin the Short to distinguish him from his grandfather. He ruled well, he was an able general, but he was only mayor of the palace. And right here you have two politicians, each of whom had a desire, and they found that by uniting forces, each could help the other, and the results have been tremendous for all the world ever since that they did so. One of these is Pepin, who is mayor of the palace, and he gave the orders, and the armies followed him, occupying the southern half of what is today Germany and the northern three-fourths of what is today France. He gave the orders, and they followed. He ruled the kingdom, but he was only mayor of the palace. And if he were to put himself up to be a king, who knows, there might be an uprising that would destroy him. But this Merovingian living in debauchery and not even knowing what was happening in the kingdom was an nominal king. How could he get the title of king and get the power in his own hands? Now, at the same time, down in Italy, the most influential man in Italy was the Bishop of Rome. But the Bishop of Rome saw that Italy was becoming united under a Germanic people who had gradually become more and more civilized and who was beginning to take over control of Italy and would soon have made Italy a nation under their control. They were Arians and gave no allegiance in any sense to the Pope. In fact, occasionally when a new Pope had to be elected and the two bodies couldn't agree which one should be elected, they had to call in the Lombards, this Germanic group, to keep order, while the followers of the Pope decided which one would win out and elect their man as Pope. But the Pope didn't like to have the Lombards make a united kingdom of Italy. He wanted to be supreme in Italy. And Pepin wanted to be king instead of having the Merovingians be supreme there. And the Franks had adopted Catholic Christianity, if you remember. That is the view of the Nicene Creed, is what the word Catholic meant in those days. So here are these two men, hundreds of miles apart, each of whom has a desire the other to meet. And there is no way in which they, at that time, would be in the way of each other. And so they got together, with results that have affected Europe to this day. They got together, the Bishop of Rome, who was respected throughout the Western world, partly for the greatness of the city of Rome in ancient times, and partly for the ability of Pope Leo, about 450 AD, they got together. And the Pope said that the man who has the power and is really ruling should have the name, and therefore, if Pepin will come down to Italy, he will crown him King of France. And Pepin said, the Bishop of Rome should be freed from the power of these Lombards. I will put down the Lombards with my Frankish troops and will free the bishop from the fear of having a united Italy that is not subject to him. And so Pepin, in 752, was crowned by the Pope and became King of France. And Pepin, two different times, went with a large army down to Italy and defeated the Lombards, and he gave a donation of a large section of Italy to the Pope, which the Pope could rule. And Pepin's donation became important in establishing the temporal power of the Pope. Well, now Pepin was important, but his importance is completely overshadowed by his son. And his son is one of the able figures of history. His son, whose name was Charles, and whom the Germans call Charles the Great, the French have formed the name into one word, Charles the Great, the word Charlemagne. And Charlemagne is the way he is generally known to us in history, the French for Charles the Great. And Charles, the son of Pepin, continued to have the same relation to the Pope as his father. The Pope had to have Charles' support if he was going to rule over a substantial part of Italy, because the Lombards were getting more and more civilized and getting stronger and stronger, and threatened to build a unified kingdom of Italy, which would have been a good thing for the Italians, certainly, and which would have occurred in 750 or so A.D. instead of having to wait till 1870 A.D. if it were not for what Charles Pepin and Charlemagne did in putting down the Lombards and giving the power to the Pope. So Charlemagne and the Pope worked together. But Charlemagne is of even more importance in history than that. Charlemagne is a man who was out of his prime. That is to say, in ability, in knowledge, in understanding, he is one of those figures that tower above all of his associates. He's a man of remarkable genius. And the fact that you have this brilliant light right in the middle of our dark age period is evidence that one man alone, no matter how great, cannot change the world. Charlemagne, for a brief period, seemed about to change Europe from being a region of the Dark Ages into a region of high civilization. And the light burned brilliantly while he lived and then sputtered out. And you have two, maybe three more centuries of Dark Ages after him. He was not able to reach very far with the brilliance of his activity. But while he lived, his power was beyond description. We cannot take time in this course to go into many of his achievements. From a military viewpoint, he's one of the great men of history. He held back the Mohammedans, put them entirely back into Spain, even reconquered for a brief time some sections of Spain. He conquered all of northern Germany, the great numbers of people we call Saxons in northern Germany were conquered by him, became subject to him, were forced to be baptized and become nominally Christian, and the He extended the borders of his empire. On three or four occasions, he went to Italy with his army and completely conquered the Lombards. And by the end of the third time, the Lombards were no longer a great force in Italy. Italy, for the next two centuries, was just a lot of little sections fighting against each other, and there was no chance of it being unified because the power of the Lombards was gone. As a conqueror, as a ruler, as a military man, he was tremendously powerful, but he was a man who was interested in education, interested in culture. He couldn't read and write. He eventually learned to write his own name, which was quite an achievement for those days. But he knew Latin well, and when Latin was read to him, understood it thoroughly, could talk in Latin and also could understand Greek. He went sent over to Ireland and got some of the best scholars to come over and try to develop education among his people. He was studied theology, and there were certain books called the Caroline Books, which have a very clear understanding of certain features of theology, which some say he wrote himself, others that he had them written by some of the scholars whom he brought there. But he was a man of tremendous genius and tremendous ability. And if one man could change the world from dark ages into civilization, Charlemagne could have done it. But after his death, the light that he built sputtered up, and the Europe relapsed into barbarism and illiteracy as it had been before. Now, Charlemagne held all of Germany, and all of France and Germany and Hungary and all that tremendous section, and whenever he was there, he held Italy. And in 800 A.D., the emperor of in Constantinople died, and his wife took over the power. And the Pope said, how can a woman be emperor? And Charlemagne said, I am the ruler of the old Western Roman Empire. Why should not I be emperor? And there's no clear proof what happened, whether Charlemagne said to the Pope, you crown me, I'll be emperor of the Roman Empire in the West. Or whether the Pope, as some Romans say, surprised him on Christmas Day as he was kneeling in St. Peter's by coming up and placing the crown of empire on his head. Well, of course, there's a picture in the Vatican that shows it happening, so I suppose that's what must have happened. But the picture was drawn 800 years later, so I don't think it's proof of it. But whatever did happen, for the first time since 476, 300 years earlier, there was a man in the West who claimed to be emperor of the Roman Empire. Well, now that revived the idea in the West that there should be an emperor in the West. Of course, they claimed he was emperor of the whole Roman Empire. But actually, nobody ever thought of recognizing his power in the East. The Harun al-Rashid, the leader of the Mohammedans in Baghdad, sent representatives to the great emperor of the West, to Charlemagne. They exchanged letters back and forth. He was a man of worldwide influence in his day. But when he died, he was succeeded by a rather powerless son of little ability, and his three sons divided the kingdom between them. And it degenerates. Some of them are called emperor, but they're certainly not emperor in any real sense. And so it degenerates, and there's a period of nearly 200 years, or 150 years at least, before anybody else really could be thought of as an emperor in the West. At the end of our period, just before 1000 B.C., France is divided into little groups fighting each other, or occasionally having little to do with each other generally, but occasionally fighting each other. And there's a man called Hugh Capet, C-A-P-E-T, who is on a little island in the Seine River, which becomes the center of present Paris. And from him, all subsequent kings of France were succeeded, were descended. So you see, the line of kings of France only begins at the very end of our long period of dark ages. Similarly, over in Germany, in the period after 900, or 100 years after Charlemagne, in that period, there are little sections, they're larger than the sections in France, in which a ruler holds a considerable section of Germany. And these rulers try to get together and to have some cooperation among themselves, and so they elect one of their number to be emperor or leader over the rulers of Germany. And one who was thus elected in 962 went to Italy and got the Bishop of Rome to crown him as emperor of the Roman Empire. And so in 962, Otto I was crowned emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And from him until 1815, there succeeded emperors, not all descended from him by any means, but there was a succession of men who claimed to be emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, which Viscount Bryce said it was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. But all the history during that 1,000 years is tremendously affected by the effort of the German king to be recognized as emperor of the West, emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, and the effort of the Bishop of Rome to profit by him, but yet to be superior to him. And we'll see much of that during the next period of 500 years. It barely begins at the end of our long period of dark ages. So we want to survey this period before we get on to the next and say a little about the religious life in it. But before we do that, we look at two other countries. Number 11, England during this period. And England during this period is a little bit similar to France in that there's a period of brightness in the middle, only it's later in England. But England during this period is quite different from France because the channel separated from the continent. You remember that in Italy, shortly after 400, the Roman troops withdrew. And the Britons, who had been protected by the Romans for 400 years, now found themselves facing the wild Picts and Scots from the north who were making forays into the country. And in order to protect themselves, they sent over the continent, at least some say they did, and got some of these Germanic people to come over they would hire them to drive back the Scots. But once they drove them back, they weren't content. They decided to take over. And so then the Britons had to fight the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes. And for 150 years, we have no information on conditions in Britain. But during this time, the Britons, who had thought they couldn't resist the Scots and now found themselves facing a stronger and more ferocious enemy, now were gathering their forces and doing their best to resist, but were being gradually driven back until what remained of them were up in the hills of Wales. But these Angles and Saxons and Jutes from the mainland who came over in great numbers, they gradually gained control of England, and eventually missionaries came to them from Rome. We'll look at them later under different heads. But it was at about 600 that they came, and they gradually won over the old paganism there. But then there came the attack from Denmark, and the Danes attacked. And for a time they held half of the territory. In fact, for a period there was a Danish ruler. But these Danes were also Christianized. There was one Danish ruler named Canute, who they say that his people were giving him great praises as to what a wonderful man he was. He could control everything. Why, his courtiers said, even the waves will do what you say. And so he had them take his throne and put it out on the seashore. And then the tide was coming in, and he ordered the tide to stop. And when it didn't stop and came right up and lapped on the floor of it, they say that Canute said to the men, "You see, that I'm not as powerful as you think I am. I'm just a man. I can't direct the forces that God controls." Well, now, whether that's true or not, we don't know. There were probably some of these things who were thus Christian like Canute, but a great number of them were wild barbarians from the north who were ravaging and pillaging in Scotland, Ireland, and England. And the Saxons were struggling against them. And in the midst of this struggle, there's only one name of a ruler that stands out in England during this whole 500 years, and that's the name of Alfred. And Alfred reigned from 871 to 900. You see, nearly a century after Charlemagne. And there are many stories about Alfred. We don't know just how many of them are true. But he seems to have been an able fighter and also a man of high character. And he tried to introduce education among his people. These different Saxon groups gradually coalesced by conquest or by cooperation or in one way or another, until by the end of our period, at about 1,000, you have Saxon rulers over this area called England, and the area is nominally Christian. And most events of importance in England come after this period. Aside from Alfred, there's very little, and the events connected with the original missionary work there, which we'll look at later, there's very little that we need bother about in England during this whole period of 500 years. Now, number 12, Italy during this period. We've already touched on Italy. We don't need to say a great deal more about it. We will say much more about it as we look at the history of the papacy during this period, a little later. But during this long period of between 500 and 600 years, in Italy, various Germanic tribes came in, gradually became civilized, reached the point nearly of making a unified nation, and then it was stopped. The first of them was the East Goths, under a man named Theodoric. And Theodoric was an able ruler. He was there shortly after 500 AD. He was an able ruler. He nominally called himself a representative of the Eastern Empire, but actually he was in no way subject to him. He was ruling and gradually unifying the territory. But he was an Arian. And after his death, his territory was destroyed by the forces of Justinian. It's interesting that Theodoric built a considerable civilization there and had a considerable headquarters, and it was important enough that Hitler thought of Theodoric as the first great Germanic ruler, and so even during the war, when he was fighting for his life on all fronts, he sent a prominent archaeologist, an old friend of mine from Germany, down to Italy to spend the whole time measuring the old fortresses of Theodoric and making pictures of them and planning a big book telling about Theodoric that was to be published after Hitler won the war. Hitler lost the war, and so the communists took over this particular archaeologist and sent him to Peking to give lectures on quite a different viewpoint than Hitler had in mind. But Theodoric was destroyed by Justinian. And then we have the Lombards, as we mentioned, who would have made a unified Italy had it not been for the Pope bringing in the people from France. And after that, in Italy, you have little separate divisions. The Pope claiming a section in the center. In the south, the Norman conquerors were holding about two-fifths of Italy for quite a considerable part of this time, Sicily and southern part of Italy. In the north, various Lombard groups were holding it. It continued disunited until 1870. Now, so much for A here, and now capital B, monasticism in the Dark Ages. And during these 500 years of Dark Ages, if it were not for monasticism, it would seem that civilization would have disappeared and we wouldn't even know there'd been an ancient Roman Empire. But we notice the beginnings of monasticism. We've seen something of the good and something of the evil features of it. But a very important effect in connection with monasticism came about at the very beginning of this period. So we'll call number one under this, founding of the Benedictine order. From 480 to 543 in southern Italy, there lived a man named Benedict. Eventually, he built a monastery at a place called Monte Cassino. It was destroyed during the World War. It was very much in the papers at that time because the Germans used it as a center for observation. It was destroyed at that time. But Benedict was a man who succeeded in organizing monasticism. Before that, it had been entirely distinct in different areas with different types of rules developing, and it was pretty much a fluid thing. But he developed an order which was named after him and which exists to the present day. He found that though these monks went together, or they went out into the desert originally, nominally for the purpose of prayer and of prayer and study of the scripture, and in some cases that might be true. In many cases it was just laziness. And even if it wasn't, when people have nothing they have to do, they're apt to fall into wickedness. And so he organized his groups to be under control of leaders who would give them definite work to do and keep them busy and oversee their lives. And he established a rule which is followed to the present day by those who call themselves Benedictines. And they wear a black costume, so they came in the later Middle Ages to be called black friars. So they weren't actually friars in the true sense of that word. But the Benedictines became very important through the Middle Ages and even to this day in the Roman Catholic Church. They are the first of the so-called orders. So number two, preservation of learning in the monastery. Benedict started them out tilling the soil, doing various types of work there, physical work. But eventually they started in copying manuscripts. And it's amazing, I was reading a discussion just yesterday about the old Ethiopic version of the Bible. Well, you find our manuscripts only go back to the 12th and 13th century. If somebody in some of these monasteries hadn't copied them about that time, they might have disappeared. And that's the way. They were copying Bible manuscripts. They were copying other manuscripts. And what we know of the ancient world is largely due to what was copied. And in these monasteries, probably most of the monks couldn't read and write, but there were always a few who did. And when a man like Charlemagne needed people who could read and write and send his letters and help him with advice, he was apt to get them out of these monasteries. And it's hard to think what would have happened in the Middle Ages if there had not been the amount of preservation of learning that was carried on by these monasteries. Well, we continue there tomorrow.